This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us...
I'm Finlay Mason and I am with...
John Ward.
Now John, in an earlier conversation we spoke about how your interest in classical music grew and out of that your collecting of records, initially the 78s and then through to vinyl and now of course the compact disc. I'd like to talk perhaps a little bit now about the radio room and the radio station. That came about as an inquiry initially from people at Massey?
Yes. For me to listen to a broadcast of theirs in classical music.
Okay, but then you found there were difficulties actually in working in with Massey there, so you set off on this direction independently.
Well, the question I mentioned to, asked rather, the person that rang me initially to record, I met him in a shop later. I'd given him my response to his well-meaning broadcast, and it was fine. But I said to him, I'd just come back from Auckland, and on the car radio I heard Auckland with wall-to-wall Mozart. I wondered if it was such a wonderful thing that Massey could broadcast such a thing, you see, and I'd be prepared to make up programs for that, for his radio broadcast. He said, oh, what medium? I said, tape. That's the easiest one for me. I could transfer my music to that. He said, no, can't do tape. We don't use tape. So the quality wasn't good enough for him, so that was it. It eventually came round to my house and had a look at the records and said, look, he had noticed a jukebox mechanism. It's a huge rotund rotary programming jukebox mechanism playing CDs. And he said, will that play classical music? And I said, well, it does. It can play classical music. He loaded it all up with 100 discs and pushed the button once and would never stop. Oh, he said.
However, that's not what your normal punters were looking for from a jukebox.
No. They were. Yeah, so when he went upstairs and had a look at the records and things, you see, and he said, gosh, the troubles with Massey, they couldn't afford the music base. And that was my collection up there, and it had cost me heaps of money, yes, I'll agree with that, but over a long period of time. I mean, CDs have been with us since 82, I think, and that's when I bought my first CD, around about 85, I think it was, 84, 85. But they were horrible sounds. I had to learn to play the jolly things first. And finally, with the help of the Williamson's simulators for the recording company's curving of how they record records, I put that into practice. And hey presto, I ended up with CDs sounding as brilliant as records, probably even better, because my surround sound effects, which I have in my gramophone room, I've had for since 1963, was so vivid that it made the CDs wow. There was no scratch noise, no hurry scrape noise of the needle.
But it's a big step from here, having the music on CD and actually getting it out to the public, isn't it?
Well, that's another story. And I said to him, he said, well, you've got the record here. He said, why can't you do it? And I said, well, I know nothing about transmitters. Not a thing. I've never built one. I'm strictly audio. He said, well, he said, we can help you there. I've got a fellow that'll build you a transmitter and do order. And put me in touch with them. And within 3 weeks, they had me set up with an aerial transmitter, and I was operating.
Now you said you knew a fella who could build one. There was nothing off the shelf that you could use for your transmitter.
Well, I didn't consider it because of the cost factor.
Yeah.
And importation and all that sort of nonsense. I knew nothing about it. And this fellow had been in that's his hobby. So he knew what I wanted, and away he went. And it was brilliant.
But it's not just a simple matter of setting up a transmitter and turning on a switch and sending out. There is certain legal obligations you have, aren't there?
Oh, well, in being in the business of recording, in particular with the jukeboxes, I've been paying royalties for all my life. That's part of the reason why I can do these things.
And so those royalties applied to your transmitted music as well?
Well, yeah, yeah, I can play music in public.
Yeah.
And I have a licence that allows me to do this.
Right. Now, that's the other aspect, of course. You've got to be licensed by a government authority to do this.
No, not. I don't think it's a government authority. I really don't know. It's the government do set it, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And they set maximum sort of power of transmission and that sort of thing?
No, only that's another thing. The amateur broadcasters with FM of any nature, it doesn't matter what they broadcast, if they use, they allow you to run on the broadcast on transmit from the what they call the bands, the edge bands on either side of the broadcast band, the regular broadcast band, and so that's either down below in frequency, in concert program, I suppose is 89, well, they've allowed you to go down to some 87.
So they issued you with a band?
FM frequencies.
Right, okay then.
And they issued the one up the top as well, later, which starts at 106. 0.6, I think it is, and I'm broadcasting at 106.7.
Now, of course, the easy way then was just plug in, switch on, and start transmitting.
End of your preamp, the preamp which goes into the normal audio amplifier. It was that output that you have a control and make sure it's damped, and it goes then into parallel to that of your listening device into a transmitter. You have to monitor it, of course, as you go.
Now, early days, this may have been as simple as sitting down, inserting a disc into your player and transmitting that, but obviously your what you have now is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that was not going to work. So you had to devise a system whereby you could do this remotely.
Rather, I simply put the discs into. I bought a 400 disc CD player, which lasted for months. It was continuously revolving, and to allow for two programs that I was currently running, I bought two of them, and then I found I had to have another two as backups. So that's four of them. And they weren't all that expensive. I was surprised at how cheap they were. So, I mean, for the four of them, I'd only put out a couple of $1,000.
That's right. Cheap is a comparative term, isn't it?
Yeah. There's nothing like the electronics that they try and sell you in the shop. I mean, you buy a whole stereo for a couple of $1,000, and in fact, a quarter of that. So,
but we've moved on now from the mechanical disc player, haven't we?
Yes. How did that happen? Was that I really wanted to have an idea of not being around to manage even the automation of a 400 disc player, and to also insert, I had to put into the signal my call sign. Now that wasn't achievable the way I was running the radios of CDs in a hurry, except that if I could put a file into something with my announcements in it, and
which was a condition of your license, you had to identify your station.
The license of my broadcasting only with the government departments. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the radio inspector. Now I mentioned the radio licenses isn't really controlled by the government. It's controlled by the record companies and record and the musicians, mm-hmm. the music makers. Mm-hmm. That's where it's controlled, and they have a. We all belong to that. As a member of the APRA, Australasian Broadcasting and Playback Rights. Mm.
Mm. So that led to your development of the hard drives, for instance, which then had your music.
Mm. They were much larger than any 400 disc player could manage.
And with a reliability factor as well.
Very much.
Yeah.
Mm. And I could put all my audio files in it in respect to my voice announcements.
But of course, this would mean sitting down and transferring your discs onto this.
Yes, device. I had already, to save the wear and tear of the records, unloading and offloading the records tended to scratch them just a little tad, and it was a bit annoying that I couldn't afford to waste my records in that manner, so I simply transferred them all to written discs, and so I copied every one of them to play them, and they were expendable, and that way I wasn't worried about how badly they got scratched or they got damaged. I could simply replace them, but in doing this I had to put them through a hard drive. So, and make sure that the levels are all similar to each other and all that on my drives. And that was a matter of only copying the drives, not onto discs, but simply onto another form of drive that for a USB input of some sort to run through a media player and onto the transmission. Through the preamps, normal regular preamps. So as though instead of playing a record, either a CD or a vinyl or whatever record, you simply play a USB stick, for instance. USB running at MP3, in my case, I'm running it in WAVE. Very large program.
Then, in time, video discs became available, and the classical music. Concerts became available in video audio form, didn't they?
AV, yes.
And then when you got involved in that, did the you now have through U3A you have the sessions that you conduct here now? When did that come about?
Oh, it was the invitation of really U3A to run the music one, and they didn't have anybody doing it. They had opera, yes. And that was it.
Yes.
And so I took up the cudgels and
set up your household as a viewing room.
No, well, actually, it was before that. I was running the radio, of course, and the idea was that I could play the radio. And I had one or two characters coming into from town, from their houses, coming into town and listening to the radio broadcasts, because I'd put the program that I was going to run that day as a U3A program. And it was funny them watching them on their push bikes, them telling me the stories that they go around the corner in a street and they have to twist their head in the opposite direction the way they're going to maintain the signal in their headphones, so they could hear the jolly thing.
So now through U3A, you have a monthly session of a number of different categories of music and other...
Everything, like comedy. And I've turned it all into video, the whole lot of it.
Yes.
So that it's AV, everything. Yeah. And I can use those records as they are and broadcast them as they present them, but I can't put the video part in. That's all.
Right. Now you say comedy. Is there a particular genre that you favour?
Oh, yes, there is. Yeah, anything BBC.
Right. And now I understand also another one of your interests is railway, and you've been able to combine this with your...
Yes. Not for the broadcast.
It's not for broadcast, but for your...
Sound effects in U3A.
Yeah, righto. And this again is another session you conduct in your home here with those who are interested, who share that interest.
Yes, that's true.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and I introduced the sound effects on tape in the little theatre way back in 1949, it was. And I had a lot of fun with tape and sound effects. And Railway came in on that. I always wanted the real thing, you know, utilise.
You're saying in support of live stage productions, you produce the sound effects.
Mm.
Well, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, it was.
That'd be something you couldn't do remotely. You'd have to sit there and press
exactly.
The
and the funniest one was trying to get to all the two very, very funny ones. One was we were doing a Terence Rattigan play to be presented at the Opera House, and there was a great scene right at the very beginning. Here's this lady with a fag in her mouth, and she was all done up with a bow, headscarf, and she was busy ironing away there, and slinging off at her old man, who was sitting at the back of the stage in the toilet. They called it the bog, and there was smoke coming out from underneath the door. He was busy having a fag in there, you see. And it was funny as right to watch. And you could hear the newspaper flicking around, you see, in there. He's reading a newspaper. And she's in there, in the front of the kitchen there, working her heart out, doing his ironing. Anyway, in the finish, he gave up on that. And he came out through the door. And just as he was doing that, he pulled the plunger. You see, to do the toilet. Now I had to go around the houses. I found a house in Florence Avenue that had just the right sound for a plunger toilet, and I recorded it in stereo. Not stereo. I recorded it in real hi-fi sound. You see, and here it is. I played it back on the stage for the first rehearsal, dress rehearsal, and since that. Plunger went clunk, and all this gurgling noises and things, cascading water sounds. It was a tremendous. They burst into. They had to have a tea break. They couldn't carry on. They were laughing.
So you had to be on the ball. You couldn't go to sleep, sort of, on the job there.
Oh, no.
Those sort of things
much.
Had to come in on
too much. Yeah, it was too much fun to go to sleep on.
So this was an ongoing commitment of yours to provide sound effects for various stage productions.
Oh yes, yeah, operatic, the whole works. And I ended up recording all these shows, and I have a library full of these recordings.
That's
of these live shows in my system. And recording, just that's where I've been doing orchestral recording and applying my principles of making sound of the music schools and what have you, and selling, I was actually selling little cassettes of these, of their performances as keepsakes.
Oh, right.
And it was covering the cost of the reels of expensive tape to do it. The music schools are very heavy on tape.
Yeah.
And I still have those rolls of tape in the cupboards, pristine.
When you say the schools, this is the
music schools.
Oh, the music schools.
And the secondary schools.
And the secondary schools, yeah. Right.
Yes. The biggest one I did was the Cambridge Music School.
What sort of, over what period of time, or when did you start doing this for them?
Ever since I've had a tape recorder. 1949 that started.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
So these productions we once thought were there and gone, you have got them on?
I've got a lot of them, yeah. I think I have all the Operatic Society. They also provided me with their records that they'd made commercially.
Yes.
And they're all set. I've got a whole lot of those. I finished when Jesus Christ Superstar thing came on in the broadcasting, in the Opera House. The problem was that they had put in, they got all high tech with their stuff and putting microphones around all their little
performers had
everybody had microphones,
right.
It sounded horrible,
yeah,
through the speakers, and it was unrecordable,
right.
Totally unrecordable, okay, and the noise was so.
And that, of course, is the trend now, isn't it? All of these live productions
it's all done like that now.
Yeah.
And it just destroys it. You've got to have a special recording session if you're going to do that.
Indeed.
Without that rubbish. So it absolutely destroys it. And that alluded me to just about to where the other good recording came. It was a sound effect, too. But... recording in has been a...
And now have you finished buying records?
No.
Oh. is there music that you haven't got that you're looking for?
There's a whole heap of music that came out. We'll blame Napoleon for the whole episode of he began it with his destruction of all the little empires and kingdoms in Europe, and it became a blockade of Europe, and it lasted 200 years, well after when the communists took over and knocked out the beginning of classical music was really in Bohemia, in Prague, the Sitka Valencia school, and it came of age around 1750, and from then on it went through Europe like wildfire. It was a complete change from music that Bach wrote, J.S. Bach. Indeed, J.C. Bach, the youngest son, was demonstrating this new music, classical music, in London. And Mozart actually went to London when he was about 8 years of age and 10 years of age, and his father would take him through there regularly for the good of his health and the fact that he... going into these special spring baths that they had in London. And he met up with J.C. Bach and Abel and the composers, and it was that music that was put into Mozart. He grew from it.
So you're saying there's a large group of composers who were virtually unheard of for many, many years, and now some of their music is becoming available.
When they pushed the Berlin Wall over, the Eastern Bloc produced all these magnificent performers. They had instruments in their mouths. They absolutely flooded the market with new music that had been written 200 years before.
And the new music was coming out of there was recordings of local orchestras.
Their local orchestras,
yes.
The Prague Philharmonic.
Yes.
And they were cagey about it, the fact that they wouldn't sell the paperwork, they sold the finished product. And the realisation of this really came when the Czech Philharmonic came out here. And I'd never heard, it was beautiful to hear the Czech Philharmonic playing the Eroica Symphony.
And other music that you'd never heard of before.
I
see.
Czech music.
These recordings are becoming fairly readily available now?
Look at the World's Oyster.
Okay, then. Mm. Mm.
except they're going out of CDs. You can buy them more readily in videos, concert videos now.
Okay, then. Which could still be adapted, presumably, for your broadcast?
Oh, yes. If I haven't got anything in a performance of that, I can put it on the...
And you are adding this to your repertoire?
Oh, once or twice I've done that already, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Oh. The music lives on, or is
it? I think so.
Right.
And it doesn't matter the medium, whether it's the CDs or whatever. I do object to receiving stuff over the net. The music's horribly compressed, and they can't put the volume of megabytes or whatever it is in the clumps that they need to do to maintain the high quality of nice, rich surround sound audio.
And anyhow, you wouldn't have the rights, presumably, to take music from the internet and broadcast.
I haven't ever done it.
No.
Hmm. Yeah, but that's the way it's going. And all the they go along with this Bluetooth system, and they filter it into the stereo systems that are in the shops and in the pubs and anywhere.
Yeah.
And completely obliterating the useful meaning of entertainment and music.
Right. So Palmerston North is, and Fielding.
Mm.
Which is reached by your radio station, are now becoming acquainted with music that many others around the country have not heard before.
Never hear it, no. It's never played on national radio. Too much talking on it for playing too much music. No, but anyway, that's the radio inspector actually said to me that I'm unique in the Southern Hemisphere. The only one he's heard of, and he didn't like it. Mm-hmm. To the other recording of note was an experiment in surround sound of the top dressing aeroplane we recorded running up the Bahangana Valley. In my more advanced stages of recording on tape, they were fully stereo, and this one recorded the Doppler effect of the engine of the motor going up the valley, Bahangana Valley, going past all the little valleys, doing this run. He was doing top dressing at the head of the valley. Well, he got there and the motor disappeared for a while. Then finally, in a heck of a sudden bun rush, he came back over the valleys, the tops of the valleys this time, not going up the main valley. He'd come back over the tops of all the little tributary valleys into the main valley, and it appeared in our valley, way up in the Bahangana. Suddenly there was a cutting edge of a blade and the roar of the engine over the top. Well, I lined all the children up on this is in my demonstration gramophone room of this recording. Lined all the children up on and they had a cat between them, Ruffles the cat, and they sat on this couch facing the front of the unit of the gramophone room and right across. Now I had speakers, there was 11 channels running in there, and the speakers all over the phased channels, tetrahedral sound. Now imagine a tetrahedron, well, it's the shape of the speaker set up in the gramophone room, overhead and everything. Well, the kids were sitting there, apprehensive. They heard the sound of the plane moving up the side of the side of the valley, with all the Doppler effect sounds going in and out. And next thing we saw was Ruffles the cat suddenly put his head up sharply and ducked. As soon as he ducked, the kid screamed because the jolly old cutting edge of the blade of the aircraft must have been a very high frequency, but a terrible noise. They thought the plane was coming straight at them from above. And, it was the most demonstration-worthy sound. And it suddenly just disappeared over the top of them and over the back disappeared out of sight, with more Doppler effects going on further out. That was 1970-something, 78, somewhere around then. Mm-hmm. And I was very proud of that.
You would have been.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Now, the microphone setup for this was, in fact, a 60 feet width, and they were set in the usual 90 degrees to the sides, so that they recorded each side sort of in a 180 degree shift. Mm-hmm. And as the microphones also look backwards and frontwards, so we ended up with the anti phase, with the negative phase compared with the positive on the other side, where they came together, where they matched. That was all the signal that we required for the sound to be coming from the rear.
Yeah.
Properly decoded. Yes, I heard the demonstration of surround sound when I was working at Decca's in London in 1961. Went into a demonstration of the Columbia Graphophone Company, and the demonstration was stereo, celebration of stereo, 30 years stereo. Wow. I told the boys, well, we'd only known stereo 3 years at that stage. This is 1961. Well, I couldn't believe that Alan Blumen, as it was, doing the demonstration and developed all this. He was killed in an aircraft crash in 1941 in Wales, demonstrating the dropping of bombs to do the dam busting, because he designed all the bombing and everything, all the sum and differential sort of work, from 3 points. Exactly the same principles as he developed the stereo. That he'd done in 1931. Anyway, this demonstration was him. We're in a four-post of speakers, and we had to walk in the middle of this. Stood there, and Alan Blumen was walking around us. Started on the top right, and he explained it, and clonk, clonk, down to bottom or rear right. And then he said he was going to go from rear right across to top left, diving across us. Well, he walked right through us and talked as he it was brilliant. I'd never ever experienced that on a two channel recording ever. Mm-hmm. And the sum and differential sound is just blew stereo away for a six. As far as I was concerned, I was never going to look back. I had it in my gramophone room. I developed it all out of the thesis that the boys wrote from Cambridge and Oxford, and I had this jolly sound going beautifully in 1963. I reckon it would be the first one in the country.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.